Welcome to the PreparedX Podcast, your complete source for crisis, emergency, business continuity, and security preparedness interviews, news, and much more. Now, your host, he creates chaos for a living, Rob Burton.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 20. I can't believe it's been 20 episodes already. Of the PreparedX podcast series. In this one, this is a great interview with Mike Lawrence. Mike is the Chief Reputation Officer at Cone Communications. Mike gives a fairly detailed introduction of his career in journalism and then on the public relations side in the corporate space. So I won't go into too much about Mike. We have worked with Mike in the past. He's great to work with. And Cone Communications are certainly great public relations as well as communications firm to work with. We got talking about a wide array of crisis communication related topics. We discussed some of the fundamentals that organizations should have in terms of their crisis communications capabilities. We also spoke about the ambush interview, and Mike, with his experience as a reporter, but also his experience with educating executives on how to respond to the ambush interview if you don't have the relevant information. So there's some sound advice there. We obviously got onto social media and the impact of social media during emergencies. We got talking about how almost it's live now. You know, we have Facebook with the live button that you can press, and so you can live stream an emergency to Facebook, which presents a whole range of challenges for organizations. Mike also spoke at the International Crisis Management Conference earlier this year, and so he had a great talk there and presentation. And he talks a little bit about that in this podcast. And so anyway, he's a true professional in every sense. I think you're going to like this one. Here's the interview. Hi, Mike. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome, Rob.
Mike, before we get going here in today's podcast, could you, for our audience, just provide them with a little bit of your background, kind of your career to date, as well as your current position as the Chief Reputation Officer at Cone?
Well, glad to. I started out in journalism in the early 1970s on radio and television in Providence, Rhode Island, and was a reporter and television news producer there for several years, and then moved out to the Midwest and was an anchorman on television in Indianapolis for 4 or 5 years, covering a wide range of things, including the court system and state and federal government. And then In 1982, I came to Boston as a reporter and anchorman at the NBC affiliate there, and for the next 16 years covered all kinds of news, especially business and technology, but including breaking news. And for 10 of those years, I was based inside daily newspapers in Massachusetts. So I had, in retrospect, a firsthand window on side-by-side operations of a television news operation and a newspaper, covering often the same stories in very different ways. So that added up to 26 and a half years. And after that, I career changed in 1997 to public relations, and more specifically, issues and crisis management. So I have worked for that period of time, almost 20 years now, with corporations and large not-for-profits, on crisis preparedness, crisis communications and management, and corporate social responsibility, which is the happy side of dealing with issues in the way companies organize themselves, find partners to work with, put purpose into their operations, and are accountable for the way they behave and the impact they have on society.
Sure. I appreciate that, and that's going to fit in nicely with our audience, as you. Aware that we have a lot of corporate security, business continuity, and a lot of crisis managers now. Anyone that's responsible for dealing with crises for an organization. So I think today's session is going to be well received. As we start out here, And our audience is fairly mixed in terms of their experience within the world of crisis management. You know, some have been in the trade for a while, others are just starting out in the trade, and some are getting up to speed and refreshing themselves. So I'd like to start off with talking a little bit about the fundamentals for corporations, and you know, what are some of those must-haves in order for them to be prepared for crises? You know, what should they have in place in terms of enabling them to prepare, respond, and recover from crises? You know, from your experience, what do you see corporations as must-haves?
Well, let's take a look at a handful of key things. I think, first of all, any organization that has not already dived into this area but is looking at doing so needs to identify and understand the organization's risks. Some risks are universal for companies and not-for-profit groups, but others are specific to their industry. So when you think about risk and identifying risk, it should not just be the obvious, which is physical risk or business continuity risk, but also reputational risk. And more that's playing out as a factor in this wired world. That's playing out as a factor for causing crises, often ones that threaten the organization as much as business continuity. So
right.
Identifying risk is number one. Number two would be to develop a crisis plan. Everyone needs that more than ever now because of how interconnected and how quickly things are happening. And as part of the crisis planning process, some of the key things you need to address are: who will manage your crisis, which people, and in what sort of an organizational structure? What triggers the use of the plan? What's a crisis and what's not? And how do you define that? What steps get taken and in what order in the event of a crisis? Who are you addressing? Who are your audiences? And how do you reach those audiences? That's different, obviously, from one group to another. The creation of some basic template statements against the crisis. And sometimes organizations that go about this really seriously will have modules within the crisis plan that are issue specific. So, for example, the kinds of things you would need to say and the audiences that you would address, and most importantly, the order in which you would address them for an issue like data theft, would be potentially very different from product contamination, or very different still from something that's a natural disaster, such as a hurricane or a tornado,
right,
that impacts your physical plan. All wildly different.
Yep.
And then still under preparedness, spokespeople need to be identified and trained. And then desktop exercises or full-scale drills to prepare the team to do this well, to train them, to build the muscle mass. And I know, you know, that's something that PreparedX does really
sure.
well
yep.
And helps people. So those are the basic steps for prepare. I guess we can, if you want to, Rob, move to, I think you asked about responding and recovering.
Yes,
too.
Please. Yeah. Yeah. That'd be great.
So responding, number one is you have to detect the crisis. Sometimes it's presented to you, but other times it's ticking away insidiously at a low level, and it needs to be spotted before it explodes. So detection is critical, and detection comes from monitoring of the places where a risk could arise. And that could be within your supply chain. It can also typically, with our work, involves online monitoring to look for risks from external factors like consumers, customers, employees, that sort of thing, which now are often available online if you know how to look and where to look. So that's one. Part of the response strategy has to be now to get your message out before others define the crisis. That's always been true, but it's much more true now in a socially wired world, and I know we can talk about that in a bit.
Sure.
Providing periodic updates during the crisis to key audiences, fill the space with your own information, because otherwise the space gets filled with other information. Rotate your staff, because fatigue can set in to be a factor, especially now that crises are 24/7, thanks to the internet. So that's covers some of the key things for respond. For recovery, it's fundamentally to debrief, figure out what you did well and poorly, and what unfinished business is still around based on the impact of the crisis. follow up with your impacted audiences who are going to, in some cases, need long-term follow-up or communication. And then if the crisis has been a reputational one, consider something like advertising or other sorts of media campaigns if you believe that you need reputation rehabilitation, because that takes time to do. I'd say that's a fairly robust outline of the you prepare, respond, and recover.
Perfect. That's a great way to start the interview here. Earlier this year, you spoke at the International Crisis Management Conference in Boston, and your presentation was fantastic, by the way. It was very well received and continues to be well received. You touched on crowdsourced journalism, which is fascinating to me, and not being in the very specific communication field, although being connected to it in the crisis management field. It's very important and a very important subject for organizations, and that's both public and private organizations, to understand it a little more. So could you talk for a few minutes for our listeners about crowdsourced journalism?
Sure, glad to. I think the thing to know at the highest level is that whatever preparatory time that organizations used to have to ramp up for a crisis is now been taken away. We used to call that in this business, as many of you listening to this probably know, we used to call that the golden hours.
Right.
And then the golden hours became the golden hour.
Yeah.
And now it's gone away.
Yeah, right.
Because, if you think back to recent events, for example, the terrorist attacks in Brussels not long ago, we had video online, not, both outside and inside Brussels airport within literally minutes, just a few minutes after it happened. One of them was almost real time. The inside footage, which was posted online, literally showed the victims on the ground before any rescuers arrived.
Right.
So you're getting near real time. There was a time when I remember organizations used to, they'd have a crisis, say an active shooter situation, there'd be some victims fatalities, and they'd want to notify next of kin before they acknowledged that there had been fatalities. And now you'll have employees photographing the people who have died and sending that out, so that you're faced with a social media reality that you've had fatalities that you didn't want to acknowledge
right.
at this point.
And
that's just an example.
There's also live streaming now. I mean, it's just, where will this end? I mean, you can live stream.
Well, sure.
Yeah, sure.
I mean, just in the news in the last day or so, we saw an airplane, I think United Arab Emirates,
yep.
An airplane broke apart, caught fire on landing. And there was footage inside from people evacuating the plane. That came out within a minute or two once the story broke. So the airline's ability to respond to that is certainly affected by the fact that everybody within a minute or two can see what the quality of the evacuation effort was from the standpoint of the passengers.
Right, right.
You would just not have seen that, even 5 years ago. The thing that's sort of amazing, there's about 7 billion people in the world, give or take. 6 billion of those 7 billion have access to mobile phones. That's more than have access to toilets. And so in this world, they're all citizen journalists. And you combine that with a contracted news media where professional journalists have often been fired or retired, and the newsrooms around the world, certainly in the U.S., have shrunk. Then the gap in that reporting, that professional reporting that we used to take for granted, is now being filled by citizen journalism. And the media that remains are using those citizen journalists as a source
right.
in ways they would not have 5 or 10 years ago when they had colleagues around them.
Sure.
And so, and the last point on that, I think, is that the citizen journalists have not been trained as journalists. And so the rules of journalism that organizations may expect, going off the record, certain expectation of fact finding before a claim is made, an editor to review what the reporter has written or said, that's gone.
Right.
All those things are gone. And
yep.
that creates risk and exposure and a real demand for organizations to step up and speak for themselves, because otherwise people will speak for you.
Sure. Yes. There is so many different mediums now as well. So, you know, it could pop up anywhere. And so if you're not on top of all those, you know, social media platforms as an organization, we start off these crisis simulation exercises and often we'll start off with a tweet. And, you know, those that in the crisis team that don't understand social media, first of all, shouldn't be on the team, but we'll always get those comments. Oh, well, we're actually not monitoring that, but already the story is out there. We've got people that are already in trouble. And like you say, that's almost instantaneous. And, you know, with Facebook having that live, literally you can press a button now and go live. It's just a nightmare for those that are trying to manage, these types of events. Let's go on to a particular case that at some point throughout your career, I'm sure you've faced, come across many events. Is there one particular crisis that you covered, either as a journalist, in your reporter days, through the media, or since you've been on the corporate and public relations side? Is there one that has a crisis that has stood out to you over the rest, and if so, why?
Well, in my journalism career, I'd say there are two categories that stick with me all these years later from a crisis standpoint. The first one is more of a crisis that never ended, at least for years. I did reporting on the conflict in Northern Ireland during its heyday between the Irish Republican Army. Yes. and loyalists, and the British Army, who were at the time in Northern Ireland. For peacekeeping or as an occupying force, depending which side you're on,
right,
or were on. I was over there for a period, two different trips, and there was a lot of turmoil in the first trip in particular, which was in 1988. And the thing that struck me was you had here a crisis that didn't have an endpoint, and you had, and we take this a little bit for granted now because of all the terrorism we're living around. But at the time, this is pre-9/11, pre-ISIS. At the time, what you had was a Western society with democracy and court systems not unlike ours in the U.S., with an army on the street, with weapons who were, sighting pregnant women walking along with baby carriages, using their rifles as, as scopes. So, and it was a terrorism battle between two separate paramilitary forces, with the British Army in between. And Rob, I know you probably have some views and experience in this area too. The thing that struck me was that how hard it is for a democracy to maintain itself when faced with an internal security threat. And now, fast forward, we've seen some signs of that here in the U.S. over time, because the terrorism threat, of course, is now on our soil as well. But it's a struggle for people, for residents, for authorities, to maintain not just civility but the rule of law and the assumption of innocence and decorum on the streets when you have just this unplanned, unpredictable, non-ending turmoil, which is what they had for decades in Northern Ireland. It's nice now for me as a journalist. I was back in Belfast just about 2 years ago and went back to a lot of the places I knew from my reporting days. And it was a real joy to see how things had flourished in times of peace.
Sure.
You don't get that with a lot of conflicts.
Right. What's quite interesting in Europe right now is obviously the issues, France, Belgium and Germany, with four attacks throughout July. I know London, actually many cities in the UK now, have armed a number of other police officers. And there's a bit of an uproar. More guns on the streets with our police officers is not the right thing to do. And actually, there was a great video this morning posted online from a radio station. A gentleman calls into the radio station and he says, we don't need more guns on the streets, And so the question was posed to this gentleman. What about an 86 ton truck that's driving through one of our squares on a busy, commuter morning and like just knocking people down? If the police officer has a gun and can stop that person, maybe we'll save some lives. And the gentleman didn't have any answer. How would we stop that individual otherwise? It was quite interesting to see, to hear. London, who's dealt with obviously terrorism before, And has not had any significant events recently, are preparing for something like Germany have had recently, and obviously France, Paris, and Belgium. So I think Europe is coming to a whole new phase now.
Yeah, and this has raised, you know, we all of us representing organizations literally in anywhere in the Western world now, I think have to build in an assumption. I always thought this would take hold after 9/11, but it actually didn't, in, at least among the companies I've been familiar with all these years. We have to build in an assumption that tomorrow that could be us. And offices that consider themselves non-controversial and perhaps not even highly visible in profile need things like an active shooter plan.
Right.
And a level of security that they may not feel is was normal for them. And I'm, you know, candidly having that discussion with many of my clients and even with my own employer about the importance of that and the recognition, the need to recognize that as a real serious to-do.
Yes.
Even if the odds are low, they do exist. And we've now seen plenty of examples of how random those attacks can be.
That's right. Yeah. And often now that there's a new term that we're hearing now, and that's violent intruder. So, I mean, anybody with a knife, you don't have to have a gun now. It doesn't have to be an active shooter situation. It could be any, you know, type of, you know, vehicle. It could be any kind of weapon that could cause any harm to an individual or a group of individuals. So, so I think, you know, we're seeing the same thing in terms of organizations really starting to, tell their employees, look, you know, think on your feet. You know, there's a certain way to do things, but we're so used to doing it the corporate way. There's a procedure for that. We have to follow this procedure. Well, these situations are dynamic, and we have to think on our feet and hand over a little bit of the responsibilities to everybody in the organization, if it's a corporation, of course. To allow them, an element of trust. And if you see something, say something, which is a famous saying, that does, that helps with that. But also, pass along things, just little messages. If you hear something or if you see something that's out of place and you think it's not right, don't be afraid to report that. So we're seeing, corporations starting to take this very seriously now.
Yeah, and I think they're struggling to do that. I think you see that especially in the area of social media, because companies still are structured, for the most part, around controlling a message, around messages that are approved in advance by their corporate legal team about the need for that to happen before a message is put out to the external world. And you can't operate that way anymore. You cannot successfully control the message. You can participate in the dialogue. And it's a dialogue, not a monologue.
Right.
Companies are still often set up for monologues. Their corporate communications team creates a message. It goes to the legal team who dissects it, changes it, sends it back. There's back and forth about that over time until it gets into a form that is both in regular English that lay people can understand and satisfactory to the lawyers. That's often a period of days.
Yeah.
And in the world we're in now, that doesn't work anymore.
Nope.
And what happens is while that process is underway, everybody else has already determined whether you're a saint or a sinner and
right.
why.
Yep.
And by the time your message from your approved lawyers gets out in the dialogue, it's too late.
It's irrelevant. Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Sure. And I still see that. The good news is there are corporations and some not-for-profits that are much better now at releasing control of their voice to, approved and pre-trained people and letting those people run with their responsibilities on social media rather than have a lawyer dissect everything because
yep.
it won't work. It
nope.
just won't work.
Yeah.
And I think more and more companies are getting into the dialogue with the understanding that they will not be able to control it, just participate in it.
Yeah, we see the same thing. And when lawyers participate in these exercises, these drills to go through this, these scenarios, they'll put their hands up and say, well, we wouldn't say that at this point in time. And the communicators are saying, well, we have to say something. And so it goes backwards and forwards. But after a period of two or three of these sessions, the lawyers try to, they get the understanding after a while. It's like, well, we now understand why we have to have a better process for this. So
yeah.
It takes a little bit of time. But in our experience, we see them come along and they jump on the train eventually. But it takes them a little bit of time because They're not used to that. And that goes into one of the questions we had around social media. And that was certainly one of the challenges. Are there any other challenges in terms of social media when it comes to, dealing with crises? What are some of the bigger challenges that corporations face? I think that one you mentioned just there is a real, real big one. But are there others?
A few others. I think just ticking them off. Monitoring properly and having the right tools. Social media has exploded now to the level where good monitoring needs to be a combination of automated tools and human beings who are reviewing the results of what they report. So we have four or five, sometimes six different social media platforms that are active and relevant to a crisis, depending on the nature of the organization. And folks know most of them, the Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, Instagram, those kind of places. And there may be instant messaging where you have to keep an eye to as well. So automation has an advantage in presenting you with a subset of what's going on rather than you have to hunt it yourself one at a time. The days of being able to use Google alerts for social media monitoring are gone, but I'll bet there are still people hearing this call who rely on that fundamentally. So a bunch of those tools, we don't need to go into them today, but they do help. So that's one thing is the resources and the monitoring. Staffing is important for social media 24/7 in a crisis. Yes, you have to sleep, but while you're sleeping, someone else needs to be keeping an eye on what's going on online, especially with time zones for international companies. You're going to have activity all the time that will need equal attention just as fast. Who's authorized to respond? Again, as we mentioned earlier, the lawyers and the CorpCom people can't be locked down doing this. Other people need to be trained and then trusted to respond on behalf of the organization in, minutes, not in an hour or two or a day, as things have traditionally been in the past. Find a comfort level, as you've said, for the lawyering process, because the lawyering process is generally not compatible with prompt social media engagement, which takes place usually in less than an hour, 15, 20 minutes pretty typically, or people move on without you and your eventual post will be so far down on the list, no one will notice it. And then be careful, be careful about jumping to conclusions, but participate. Don't push beyond the facts, but flood the channels, the social media channels, with your involvement. Look for opportunities to respond and reply, as well as to post updated information. You won't be able to control the dialogue or the conversation, but you can structure it and steer it, but only with your physical presence. If you're not participating, then the flood will move on without you. And definitely resist the urge to try to be in control. Instead, you try to be a leader and an influencer, because that's what success looks like for companies now.
Sure. And let's talk a little bit about interviews. Let's talk a little bit about the ambush interview, which is something that executives sometimes struggle with. We see bad interviews all the time. We see poorly prepared executives that get in front of the camera. I think we saw it. The big one was the BP oil spill on the Gulf Coast a number of years ago. That's a classic one, which is used all the time. There are a number of others. I think there was one with a chemical company a few years ago where I think he was British as well, actually. He stood.
It must be something about the Brits.
I don't know what it is about the Brits, right? Yeah, we're just not good in front of the camera.
They're all so buttoned up. They like to be buttoned up.
Yeah, so
stiff upper lip.
I don't know if you remember that one. There was a big chemical leaked into the river in, I think it was West Virginia, and he stood on camera being interviewed, drinking, and nobody, downriver can drink water in, I think it was like 300,000 or 400,000 people. And so this has been going on for several days, and he's being interviewed, and he's drinking during the interview, he's drinking a fresh bottle of water. It looks nice and chilled, of course, while there's nobody can drink water downstream in these communities. It's
image worth a thousand words.
Yeah, image, and it's actually video. And he says, "Well, that's all I've got time for." And he starts to walk away, and the reporter. And we can post this one as well. This video, it's on YouTube. As part of the show notes, we'll make sure that's on there. But he starts to walk away from the reporters, and the reporter says, "Hold on a minute, I'm not finished with you." and he comes back to the camera. So she's totally in control of this individual. You know, this individual actually just went to prison. This was a serious deal. He was just given a prison sentence this year. So it was a real, you know, it's a real good case in, first of all, not being prepared as an organization because the emergency happened. But once the emergency happened, the total lack of understanding and ability to manage the situation. Anyway, there are lots of those different cases. But I think the ambush interview intrigues me because, you know, reporter popping out of somewhere and you know, trying to catch somebody off guard can be a real challenge for organizations and their staff, but also their spokespersons and those that should be trained as executives. Have you got any experience or any advice with regards to ambush interviews?
Sure. And ironically, even though the word ambush sounds like, you know, jump out from a car, an ambush interview, if you, you know, define it a little more broadly, can include a reporter coming up to you as an executive at a trade conference and starting to ask you questions in the hallway.
Yes.
That, you know, that's an ambush too, at least intellectually. If you, the thing is, an ambush interview in my book is an interview for which you are not expecting it and you are not prepared. And that, so if you define it that way, that can happen in a wide amount of places, not just when you're walking back to your car and a reporter pops out from behind another one. The key point here is, if you are not prepared for an interview, you shouldn't do it. That's, in my view, with very rare exceptions, a rule to live by. So any interview you're not prepared for is an ambush interview, in which case, if you accept my premise that you shouldn't do it, we move on to how do I avoid doing it if I've been ambushed?
Right.
And, you know, that's a question of technique. And what I train when we do media training, what I train executives to do is to find a way to politely say, tell me what you're interested in. I'm on my way to an appointment, so I can't talk now, or some version of why engaging now is not practical, or I need to go back and update my information on that topic, or something that's effectively what we call a bridge or a pivot away from the nastiness of whatever they're trying to ask you and on to a place where you can have time to prepare.
Sure.
And then promise, take their number, take their card, and promise that either you or someone representing you from the communications team will get back to them and figure out a good next step.
Sure.
So the net is, never say no comment. If you're caught in an ambush, do not use the words no comment. It's it's a red flag in front of a bull, and the bull, the journalist, will charge. Just like the bull, they won't know why they're charging,
right,
but they will charge and you will get gored.
Yep.
And so don't do that. Don't say no comment. Instead, provide a reason why now is not a good time, and there's lots of things you can say for a reason. And then take the person's card, stay polite, but do not engage. And back to the key point, which is, if you haven't prepared for the interview and haven't had time to have staff or someone assist you in figuring out the issue and backgrounding the would-be reporter, then you should not be doing the interview, even if it's an ambush.
Sound advice. I appreciate that. So as we start to wrap up here, Mike, the final question I've got for you is about the well-prepared CEO or the spokesperson for the organization. When you're preparing an executive or another spokesperson for the organization, what are some of the key messages that should be portrayed when speaking to stakeholders? And as you know, stakeholder might be the media, it could be customers, investors, and of course your employees, which are sometimes forgotten about. But what are some of those key messages that you like to portray when getting across to the various stakeholders?
Well, let's tick off a handful that hopefully can be helpful to the audience. They're kind of high level, but will steer you towards content that you can create on your own. First one will sound a little silly, but life is full of proof points that it's not. The first one is, I recognize we have a crisis. So when you appear on behalf of an organization, acknowledging that a crisis is underway is actually a very important thing to do. And there are lots of organizations that either don't address this or try to deny there's a crisis. So one that comes to mind recently, when the early stages of the Volkswagen scandal over emissions fraud, The initial interactions from the company were basically a denial of a crisis by their actions and behavior. That is almost always not going to work because everybody knows there's a crisis and there's lots of proof either out or about to come out that there is. And your denial will simply make people dismiss you and not trust you in the days to come. So acknowledge it. That's number one. I would say number two, as a key message is, to the degree there are victims, acknowledge them and show concern and empathy for them and their loved ones.
Yep.
Even if it wasn't your fault that they got hurt, if it's about something that you're involved in, then a little empathy is expected and necessary and goes a long way. Humanity in a crisis is something to be embraced, not to run from, especially if you're a CEO whose stereotypical image in the public's mind is detached, without morality or passion, self-interested, that sort of thing. So break that mold by being the opposite. Acknowledge and show concern for victims. That would be number two. Number three, talk about how you're dealing with the crisis. Are you doing fact-finding? You're trying to get to the bottom of what happened. You're taking steps to try to mitigate the impact on people. Whatever it is based on the crisis, that's where you start to talk about that. And then a fourth area would be, what, if anything, can people do to help? What do you want them to do? What are you asking them to do? How can they help you mitigate what's happened here, if at all? People are looking for a chance to participate. If you give them one to be constructive, they'll feel better about it, and you will too. They'll feel better about you. And then fifth, I would say, be very clear about your availability for updates.
Right.
So say, we will have more for you in an hour or two, or we'll have another briefing in 2 hours just to let you know if anything more has occurred. Give people a sense you're committed and you'll be back. Not you got caught this one time and you're going to be hiding from now on.
Sure.
It helps maintain some sense of control in a crisis from a communication standpoint if you have scheduled regular updates. Even if the update is 2 minutes long and says nothing's changed, you take three questions, then you go back to work. Those are all good things to do. And lastly, I would say, this is less a message and more a piece of advice. Don't overreach. You don't know in most crises right away whose fault it is. But you denying responsibility is a bad idea because it may turn out you were at fault. You just don't know yet.
Right.
And people are already placing blame, and probably some of them are placing it on you. And you're going to feel defensive and want to reject it, but you actually don't know. So you need to be very, very neutral in those kinds of judgment statements and say, it's not yet clear what all the facts are. We're looking into this. We'll sort out, who's responsible later. Now it's time to deal with the victims and try to get things back on track. Those sort of comments that leave you in a neutral place vis-a-vis who's responsible are the right things to do, at least in the initial stages of a crisis. Don't play the blame game and don't run from blame either. Just put it in a compartment, acknowledge it, and move on.
That's really, really good advice. This has been an excellent episode, Mike. Thank you very much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to do this.
You're welcome, Rob. It's been a pleasure as always.
Yeah. For any final comments for our listeners as well, if they need to get a hold of you or want to reach out to you, how can they do that?
Well, you're welcome. Anybody's welcome to email me. My email address is mlawrence, LAWRENCE, @ conecom, that's conecom.com. And I'm happy to continue the conversation with anyone that way. The firm I'm at is Cone Communications, CONE in Boston.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Mike, again. And I'll hope to see you again soon.
Take care, Rob. Be well.
Yeah. Thank you. Bye. That's it for episode 20 of the PreparedX podcast. I do hope you enjoyed this episode. If you did, please feel free to share this podcast and rate us on iTunes. I also want you to check out the Level 1 Crisis Simulation Exercise e-learning course via preparedx.net. I think I mentioned it on the last episode, so if you go to preparedx.net and you can check out our e-learning courses on there. Level 1 course gives you all the information you need to know to get you up to speed on how to put together crisis simulation exercises. A really good course. something that all crisis communication teams should be conducting regularly, these exercises. So, check that out when you get a chance. Until next time, hope you have a safe and enjoyable day wherever you are. Thank you.